The drive tower housing had melted into itself, and the monitor screen had blown out under the hardwood parquet floor. Brushing aside a thick coat of dust, she looked through the assembled, bound, and unbound spreadsheets, then the drawers beneath the counter.
There are no research notes. They were probably all on the hard drive, and that's fried.
Shall we try the other office?
They left Bob's digs and moved on to Enid's. Her expansive bookcase had similar reference works on biochemistry and human and animal medicine. But additionally, there were shelves of books on prehistoric Native American culture in the southwest United States and northern Mexico. The walls were decorated with framed photos of Little Pueblo Canyon before, during, and after the reservoir was filled in. And there were detailed photos of the cliff dwellings, the caves, and symbols their occupants had carved into the soft stone. Pinned to Enid's workstation bulletin board were duplicates of the snapshots they had seen in Bob's office, and a set of greeting cards, all addressed to Enid from Bob with love. One showed a tall, statuesque, masked woman in a black latex catsuit, complete with ears and a tail. She stood on towering high heels, brandishing a bullwhip, a kitten of a different stripe. There were others in the same vein. Heels, whips, latex, cat ear masks, Amazons.
Mead and Schumer must have had an interesting relationship.
It went well beyond the confines of pure research, so it seems.
This machine looks functional.
Apparently, Enid's computer had been shut off before the redoubt was abandoned. Mildred hit the on button.
Now we're getting somewhere.
After a few seconds, the password prompt came up.
Let's try this then. Ha! Got it!
What password did you use?
Sex kitten, of course.
I find it hard to reconcile the late Ms. Mead's physical appearance with the proclivities revealed by these missives. She reminds me more of an underfed, myopic chicken than an amorous cat.
Still waters run deep.
Mildred had already keystroked the computer's search function to locate the main research protocol files. The screen filled with a list of code names and file numbers. The most repeated code name was TAB. Mildred opened the largest document with that designation. It was an image file. A head appeared on the 24-inch screen, three-dimensionally rendered and slowly rotating. The features of the brown face looked vaguely human, but melted, flattened, and smeared. The mouth was extremely broad, and the bump of the nose as wide as the mouth. Between heavy ridges of brow and cheek, the eyes were huge and all black, inhuman. The face's covering didn't look like skin. It looked like a jigsaw puzzle of rigid plates of various sizes and shapes, held together by fine black seams of more flexible material.
What the hell?
The skull was flat, and its top bore a crest of 3-inch-long black spikes that could have been monumentally thick hairs. There were no ears or ear holes on the sides of the head. As the rear of the skull rotated into view, Mildred noted the fine stippling on its armored plates. They watched as the animation loop repeated again and again. And every time it turned to face forward, its mouth opened wide, exposing multiple rows of black-edged, pointed teeth.
What exactly are we looking at, Mildred? Is it a bizarre insect of some kind? Highly magnified?
Let's see.
Mildred pulled the scroll tab to the bottom of the image frame, where she found a specifications table. The TAB acronym was spelled out in the table's legend. Transgenic Autonomous Bioweapon.
Well, we still don't know what it is, but at least we know what it was designed to do. It's a killing machine.
Doc read through the table.
From these specifications, it cannot possibly be an insect. It weighs 110 pounds and measures 5 feet in length. It's 3.5 feet tall at the shoulder.
It's not all insect anyway. That's what the transgenic designation means. That creature is a DNA construct, a composite of different gene sources.
This is all quite baffling, I must admit.
We need a component list of the donor gene sequences Bob and Enid drew from.
Mildred backstepped to the screen of code names and started opening other tab folders until she found what she was looking for.
Here we go. Looks like Bob and Enid took sections of DNA from a wide variety of creatures.
Doc stared at the screen as she scrolled down the list.
That cannot be correct. They borrowed genetic material from a bullfrog, From a flea?
For its size, the bullfrog is a fearsome predator. It will attempt to kill and eat anything it can fit into its bucket of a mouth. Birds, fish, snakes. And a flea's fast twitch muscle fibers react hundreds of times faster than a human being's. Put that ability in a 100-pound body with the right hard wiring, and 30-foot standing leaps are a piece of cake.
And a scorpion? What are the implications of that?
Mildred flipped back to the image file, scrolling up until the creature's short arms came into view. As the image turned, a 6-inch black thorn uncurled from a pod on the back of its wrist.
There's the stinger. The poison sacs are probably under the pod, protected by the meat of the muscle and compressed by voluntary contractions. It's armed with a powerful neurotoxin. It produces immobilizing paralysis of the nervous system within 20 seconds.
I counted 6 appendages, the short upper pair and 4 longer ones.
They scanned the row of nasty-looking horns that backed each of the lower legs.
All its weapons seemed designed for close-quarters combat.
Mildred used the cursor to point out a series of holes along both sides of its torso, or abdomen.
I think those are its ears. Look at the way the side plates overlap. That body is capable of extreme cross-sectional flattening, and discounting the long rear legs, it's a fairly compact target from back to belly.
Not only fast, but hard to see.
The contributions of these other gene donors aren't obvious from the external physiology. The digestive system, endocrine system, instinctive drives, things like that.
I thought I saw something else. Return to the component list for a moment, please.
All right. Hold on.
All right. Now, scroll down. More. More. There. Stop. 5th line.
Good Lord. It has human genes in it, too.
When she double-clicked the file name, more information came up. Perhaps more than she wanted to know.
Bob and Enid gave of themselves to create that thing. Their own substance.
That's what it looks like. The transgenic autonomous bioweapon is their love child. They mingled their genetic material with that of literally dozens of other species.
Congratulations, it's an it.
There's got to be more data here on the bioweapon's capabilities.
Mildred found what she was looking for in a text file. The document was addressed to a covert government military funding source and intended as a confirmation of the research program's progress to date. In this document, the transgenic autonomous bioweapon was also referred to with a more touchy-feely nickname, Tranny.
I was right about the fast-twitch muscle fibers. That's where the Tranny gets its explosive power and speed. And it has a neural net to match.
It appears to also have a propensity to dig tunnels and burrows.
Look at those enzymatic secretions.
Though the long biochemical names meant little to Doc, he could make sense of the graph affixed to the document. It showed the corrosive effects of the Tranny's various secretions on hardened concrete over time.
What it secretes and excretes lubricates passage through its burrows and breaks down the chemical bonds of the concrete matrix, reducing it to the consistency of wet sand.
It's highly territorial. It seeks out and destroys anything living within its range.
And it's parthenogenic. It self-replicates. It doesn't need a mate to start building an army of genetically identical offspring.
What part of this thing is human?
That could take weeks to figure out. But now we know why the project had to be buried at the bottom of the reservoir. This is a new predatory life form, autonomous, top of the food chain. It makes its own command decisions based on its instinctive drives. Predictions about its behavior based on the sum of its genetics would be unreliable. The true nature of this beast would have to be observed. There's no other way to assess the interplay of new genes, body structures, and instincts.
How would such a weapon be deployed? And how would it be controlled once it's released in the field?
Some operational controls are built in, genetically hardwired. Look here. This says it's photophobic, it avoids sunlight, its preferred hunt and home locations are in the dark. That characteristic would keep it below ground, at least during the day. Bob and Enid had to have included that feature for a reason. I'd say it was so the Tranny concentrates exclusively on its assigned targets, which are most likely in hardened subsurface positions.
How would they turn it off?
That would require a termination gene. There's no other way to decommission something like this.
You have lost me again, I'm afraid.
Every living cell contains a DNA sequence that starts the death process, an automatic self-destruct that kicks in at some point, either a function of age or of external conditions. A bioengineered creature made up of a little of this and a little of that would contain conflicting and potentially disastrous self-destruct commands. The flea code would tell all the cells to die too soon. The human cells would tell cells to live too long. The death codes would have to be removed from all cells and replaced with something uniform.
A serious complication, no doubt.
If you read this document, it was the major sticking point of the entire program. The success of the project hinged on the ability to pull the plug on this weapon once its mission was accomplished. Because of its autonomy, because of its capabilities, termination had to be built in. In terms of men and materiel, the cost of cleaning out an infestation of trannies after a successful mission would have been staggering, and maybe even impossible. Deciding on an appropriate lifespan for the weapon would have required elaborate and extensive computer modeling. It doesn't look like they got that far. On the day the world ended, Bob and Enid hadn't come up with a way to kill their baby.
When Christy and Jack found the entrance to a long, windowless corridor on the 10th floor, they figured they were on the right track. As a rule, Matran's units were separated from the cores of the redoubts, perhaps for safety reasons. There was always the danger of radiation leakage, or power pulse interference with electronic and computer systems. Perhaps the isolation was for security reasons. In this case, the long hallway was the tip of the security iceberg. Barring their path, and completely blocking the corridor, was another holding cell security checkpoint. They walked through the unlocked cell and out the other side. The tile floor vibrated steadily, minutely, underfoot, and there was a faint background hum.
Sounds like the system is up and online.
Huh.
On the other side of a pair of heavy swing doors was the redoubt's Matran's terminus. Its bank of computers merrily chattered, tape and hard drives whirring as they collected and processed current pre-trans data from other stations along the wireless invisible grid. On the far wall were two port-holed steel doors, about 10 feet apart.
Two Matrans.
That's strange.
When they looked through the porthole on the left, they saw the usual armaglass walls and floor plates. This particular set was black, flecked with crimson.
Looks like standard redoubt issue to me.
Other one.
That definitely isn't standard issue.
The door to the second chamber had an additional and unique element. 2 feet from the floor, in its middle, was a massively overbuilt circular docking apparatus. Alongside the door was a wheeled cart that had been constructed around a windowless vanadium steel box. At either end of the compartment were docking hatches that matched the apparatus in the chamber door. Christy peered through the porthole window and blinked in amazement at what she saw. The inside of the second Matran's unit looked like an instrument of medieval torture, an Iron Maiden. It was lined with thousands upon thousands of needle-sharp steel spikes. 3 inches apart, they jutted from the cobalt-colored armaglass floor, ceiling, and walls. She opened the door. Right behind it was the only spike-free section of the chamber, a space of about a cubic yard, roughly the same size as the interior of the wheeled cart's box. Christy stepped around to the handle end of the cart. Attached to it was a hand-operated brake lever that locked all four wheels. On the top of the box, in front of the handle, was a red toggle switch with a caution notice. Next to that was a bulleted safety checklist.
Stranger and stranger.
The cart's hatches weren't locked. When Christy looked inside, the first thing she noticed was the bad smell. It was so vile, she jerked her head back. She held her breath to continue the examination. Around the middle of the interior walls was a line of quarter-inch steel tubing, perforated with evenly spaced pinholes. They looked like burner jets. She flipped the red switch.
Shit!
What for?
I'm pretty sure the flame makes what's inside want to leave. Makes it want to go into the chamber.
What's inside?
Good question. Whatever it is, those spikes keep it from moving away from the back of the chamber door.
Jack closed the door and looked through the window.
Blind spot. Can't see space unless door open.
This unit has transport presets.
Christy examined the chamber's wall-mounted control panel.
The redoubt locations are locked in. It can't be used for any other destinations.
Jack checked the control settings. The destination lat longs were coded, A through V.
Where go?
Christie found the answer on a large framed wall map 5 feet away. The code letters were marked and read in various locations. Siberia, Ukraine, Urals. Even Jack understood the implication of the landmass shown on the map.
Not use this one.
Definitely not.
If the map wasn't some kind of twisted white coat joke, it implied an ability to penetrate and splice into the Matrans grid of the Soviet Union's pre-dark redoubt system, to materialize some kind of cargo deep inside the most vital and protected enclaves of the enemy. They took a swivel chair from the adjoining room and put it in the unspiked Matrans chamber. Jack closed the door.